candidates ready their closing arguments for Florida's winner-take-all primary on the Republican side, as frontrunner Donald Trump denies responsibility for violence at his rallies. We'll take your calls on that and more just ahead. Good Monday morning, live from Studio 5. This is First Coast Connect on 89.9. Thanks for listening. I'm Melissa Ross. Hope you had a great weekend out there. Always listen at 9 a.m. live. You can subscribe to the daily podcast on iTunes and Stitcher and watch the show now. Video on demand at tvjax.com and metrojacksonville.com. Just ahead, we'll take your calls on violence and controversy at those Trump campaign rallies. What are your thoughts? Call in now, 549-2937. Also this morning, Episcopal School celebrates its 50th anniversary in Jacksonville, then later sports with Cole. All of that and more ahead. But first this hour, GOP frontrunner Donald Trump tried to prove over the weekend that no perceived misstep can derail his march to the Republican presidential nomination. This after widespread criticism of violence that's broken out at several Trump events recently. One in particular in Chicago had to be canceled Friday night after Trump supporters and protesters clashed in the streets. UNF's Parvez Ahmed is here with his thoughts this morning about that controversy and also rhetoric about Muslims that's marked the Trump campaign. Dr. Ahmed, thanks for being here.
Good morning, Melissa.
And here's our question to callers. What are your thoughts about Donald Trump's candidacy and its impact on the body politic this 2016 and also the Republican Party? Give us a call, 549-2937. That's 549-2937. Or go online to wjctnews.org/firstcoastconnect. Email and tweet us or weigh in on our Facebook page. And so, Parvez Ahmed, we are one day out from the critical Florida primary. Lots of delegates at stake for both Republicans and Democrats in the state tomorrow, along with primaries in Ohio, Illinois, Missouri, and North Carolina. After tomorrow night, we could be looking at a very different race. But let's begin with the controversy that's sparked up in recent days over Donald Trump rallies. There was a melee Friday night in Chicago. Trump had to cancel his rally because there was a near riot among supporters, protesters, and authorities. What are your thoughts this morning?
Well, Melissa, you know, I'm generally not very blunt in the way I talk about difficult issues. But this time I have to be, because I do feel that what we are seeing is the beginning stages of the rise of fascism in America. And it is actually a global trend. As you saw in the recent elections in Germany, the far-right party has gained substantial power now. In France, the far-right party is gaining in power. And we're beginning to see that over here. And this rise is concerning partly because of our history. You know, we 60 years ago, we were in Europe liberating a continent from fascism. And here is fascism back in our back door. When you think about violence as a political tool, think about extreme xenophobia against Mexicans, against women, against disabled people, against Muslims. This is what modern fascism looks like. And the fact that it is being fueled by a resurgent electorate that are supporting Donald Trump in the name that he will return this country to some mythic glory days is deeply, deeply disturbing. Because part of this resurgence is also based on a very racial anxiety, a racialized anxiety that has been part of the Southern strategy, Nixon's Southern strategy, for many, many decades. But now we are seeing the latest manifestation in the most crudest way possible that is provoking a kind of anxiety that can tear apart our social fabric in ways that we have probably not seen since the 60s.
We'll go to your calls, and there are quite a few already at 549-2937. In fact, the 1968 Democratic Convention in Chicago had violence, and some have drawn parallels between what happened that year and what we saw the other night in Chicago. At the same time, Senator Marco Rubio campaigning all over Florida very hard to win his home state, and he, one of Trump's main rivals, has decried this violence and this rhetoric. However, polls show that Marco Rubio is poised to likely lose his home state tomorrow, while on the Democratic side, Hillary Clinton is poised to win handily, just for those that haven't been following the polls. What are your thoughts about the other Republicans in the field denouncing Donald Trump, but at the same time, they're saying that if he does become the Republican nominee, most of them have said they would support him?
Well, it's too little too late. I think two groups of people have not stood up to Donald Trump in a timely manner. The first group would be the media. You know, initially they treated his candidacy as a joke, as some kind of as a comedic effect, celebrity, and did not vet many of his positions, did not push back on many of his positions. You know, something as egregious as when he keeps on saying that I'm self-funding my campaign. He repeats it almost at every media stop. And nobody pushes back on that and say, you're not self-funding your campaign. You actually loaned money to your campaign, and all the Trump airplanes that you're flying around, you're actually billing your campaign for it. So it's not like he's self-funding his campaign. He's raising money. He has Donald Trump on his stump, the website. And if you go to his website, the donate button is prominent. So a self-funding campaign does not look like this. So something simple as that, to many of the claims that he has made about, like, America is in decline. Yeah, America has many problems. And voters are angry. Generally, the voters of a party that is not in power would be angry during any election cycle. But anger and problems in America does not lead to racial resentment and the kind of divisive politics that we are observing right now. It is scary times. I was recently in New York with a group of Jewish leaders, and many of them, although Donald Trump has not explicitly picked on Jews as a group to target in his rhetoric, but many of them are feeling the same kind of anxiety that Muslim leaders are feeling, Mexicans are feeling, women are feeling. And it is, like I said, this is kind of a scary time. It's unprecedented, at least in the last 30, 40 years. You know, we moved quite a lot as a country in the last 30, 40 years. We have come a long way. But at this point in 2016, to see this kind of divisiveness in our country is very, very disappointing.
We'll go to your calls on this in a moment at 549-2937. So what would you say then, Parvez Ahmed, to vocal supporters of Donald Trump who feel that he is speaking for them? We're talking primarily, but not exclusively, about white Americans who have seen their economic prospects stagnate over the last 20, 25 years. And they're responding very powerfully to his rhetoric about their economic prospects, as well as some of the other rhetoric that you've talked about.
The economic prospects have stagnated for many Americans, not just white Americans. In fact, since the recovery post-recession 2007-2008, African Americans and Latino Americans have been left behind, far further behind than white Americans and other groups. So to simply say that because people have been left behind, that justifies their anger. Well, if that was the case, then African Americans and Latino Americans have more reasons to be angry than white Americans. At the same time, it is undoubtedly true that the economic recovery and the economic system under which we are operating right now is creating more and more income inequality. I have said this in many forums, that two issues that threaten not only us as a society, but the world, are income inequality and global and climate change. And those two issues, nothing in Donald Trump's policy are addressing two of the more existential threats that we are facing, one in a social way and one in a much more global way in terms of climate change. I mean, today's report, they said that the estimates, the number of people that would be affected by rising sea levels, scientists have revised it that it'll be three times more than it was previously estimated. Americans living in coastal areas, including us in Jacksonville, would be tremendously affected by that. But there is nothing in Donald Trump's platform that addresses that economic anxiety and that real anxiety about substantial changes in the way we live, including migration that may happen in this country that we have not seen in the last 100 years. And yet, given all of that, anger is one thing. It is important for politicians to channel the anger to make us rise to our best behavior. But candidates have also to give us policies. Like, what are the policies that will address this income inequality. And I don't see that in Donald Trump's platform.
Let's go to a quick clip from Sunday's Meet the Press on NBC, where host Chuck Todd asked Trump about violence at his rallies and whether he accepts responsibility for it. Take a listen.
Earlier in the week, there was an incident between a supporter of yours and a protester. And I want to play a piece of sound from a couple weeks ago from you and ask you about it on the other side.
There's a guy totally disruptive, throwing punches. I love the old days. You know what they used to do to guys like that when they were in a place like this? They'd be carried out on a stretcher, folks. Like to punch him in the face, I'll tell you.
Mr. Trump, 17 days later, that actually happened. One of your supporters decided to sucker punch a protester. Do you accept any responsibility for creating this atmosphere?
I don't accept responsibility. I do not condone violence in any shape. And I will tell you, from what I saw, the young man stuck his finger up in the air and the other man sort of just had it. But I don't condone violence. As far as my previous statement, we had somebody that was punching and vicious and gone crazy, a disruptor. They're not protesters. I'm telling you, they're disruptors. They're professionals. And he went absolutely wild punching. And frankly, when they punch, it's okay. When my people punch back because they have to out of self-defense, everybody says, oh, isn't that terrible?
Okay, what about that argument? And in particular, what about what we saw occur on Friday night in Chicago, where not only were Trump's supporters violent, protesters were as well?
Yeah, Donald Trump has a problem with facts. If you looked at the video where one of his supporters sucker punched a protester, that the person who punched the protester was not being provoked. He just came out of the left field, and Donald Trump is now saying that he wants to pay his legal bills. If that's not incitement of violence, I do not know what is. And candidates have to take responsibility. Donald Trump blames 1.6 billion Muslims for the violence committed by a handful of Muslim extremists. But he himself is inciting violence and willing to pay the legal fees of people who are taking part in that violence, but he does not want to take responsibility on that one. If that's not hypocrisy, again, I do not know what it is.
Well, we want your calls on this right now, 549-2937. Let's go to Chris in Jacksonville. Hi, Chris. You're on the air.
How are you? Good morning.
Hi, good morning.
Hey, I'm appalled at Donald Trump not taking responsibility for the actions. I mean, or not even vehemently coming against, you know, stuff that's going on at his rallies. I mean, for you not to be against it or not talk about it, it lets me as a voter know that he's cool with people getting sucker punched. He's cool with this type of violence going on. And if that's the case, I mean, what kind of president is he going to be? What else is he going to be cool with?
Chris, thanks for the call. You know, it's interesting to listen to callers like Chris as we look at new polling right here in Florida. As people are watching all of this play out around the country here in Florida, they will go to the polls tomorrow in the state's primary. On the Republican side, those delegates are winner take all. If Donald Trump wins the state, he will garner all of Florida's 99 delegates. However, new polls show Senator Marco Rubio trailing Trump badly here in Florida. Actually, Rubio has even dropped to third place in Florida behind Texas Senator Ted Cruz. So when you talk about the Florida primary GOP electorate, Parvez Ahmed, most of the voters, it seems, at least according to the pollsters, don't agree with Chris.
That's a tragedy, and that's a question that the voters will have to ask themselves. Think about 1930s Germany. There was a populist leader who was preying on people's economic anxiety and who was victimizing vulnerable minorities. And voters said, oh, we are just voting for him because he's going to solve our economic problems. We do not care about his other racial politics, his discriminatory politics, his violence towards minorities, his violence towards other people. We don't care about that because we think he will deliver us to the promised land with economic prosperity. And we know what happened then. Is that the history we want to relive? And is that the question our children and grandchildren want to ask us? Like, what did you do when Donald Trump was rising in America?
You know, for the past 20 years or so, Godwin's Law, as it's called, has been invoked whenever somebody compares a public figure to Hitler or the Nazis. They're checked on that. Mm-hmm. And I'm going to ask you right now, when it comes to this long-established president of Godwin's Law, are you going too far by comparing Donald Trump to 1930s Germany?
I have not done this with any other politician, although there have been many or any other social trend. I've been disturbed about many other issues, many other trends towards increasing racial polarization, religious animosity, but I've never done this with anybody else. And I do see the trends, and I do see the trends, not just me alone. There have been many, many social scientists who have been commenting on these trends for several months now. There's a recent study that came out by two prominent social scientists who study genocide, and they said that the conditions in U.S. today are such that a genocide against any group, whether they're Muslims or Mexicans or immigrants, is unlikely. However, all of the factors that make a genocide possible are present in our society at this moment in time.
Which are?
Which are things like
economic uncertainty, fear of violence coming in from overseas. Those are the two big things.
And victimizing a minority blaming a minority for the problems. Blaming Mexicans for all our economic problems, blaming Muslims for all our security problems, when neither one of them is true. And thinking that somehow if we can keep a certain group of Muslims away from this country, somehow all our security problems would be solved. If we can build a border, somehow immigration problems will be solved. And that will somehow solve all our economic problems as it relates to jobs. But it won't. The answer is it won't. In fact, it will make it worse. Because America will stand isolated from the rest of the world. Trade will suffer. Economic vitality would suffer. Innovation would suffer.
Lots of tweets and emails. Kingsley tweets the show, "Please, Jacksonville, vote for anyone but Trump, Rubio, Cruz, or Kasich." Mike tweets the show, "If Trump isn't to blame, why isn't violence an issue at other candidates' forums? People are frustrated, but Trump is not the answer." And here's an email from Mike in Pontevedra. "It strikes me that Trump and his method of politics is similar to that of Italy's Silvio Berlusconi. Divisiveness, dismissive, insulting, and name-calling billionaires that are focused mainly on themselves. It's not a flattering picture," Mike says, "of what could be ahead for the USA. Italy took decades to recover from 20 years of Berlusconi's political life." We want your calls, 549-2937. Peter in Argyle. Hi, Peter. Thanks for calling. You're on the air.
Hey, thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
One thing I kind of wanted to remember with the Trump discussion is that so much of what he's become, it started out that we were fed in the beginning, we were supposed to choose between Bush and Clinton. And me personally, that was really bothersome for me. So let's not forget how he started. Of course, we can judge how he, you know, what he's done with that. But I hear a lot of comments on the radio how people on the left like to say, oh, a lot of Trump supporters are not college-educated men. And to me, the where it's gone with the references to Hitler, it's kind of the other side of the coin of the Trump supporters. I mean, is it any good to really say that drawing pictures of him as Adolf Hitler? I mean, that's the other side of the camp, the other side of the goalpost. I mean, I don't really see a difference between these Trump supporters and these people who want to call him Adolf Hitler. They're both part of the problem.
Thanks, Peter. That's Peter in Argyle. Thanks for the call.
Well, except the fact that Trump has a rhetoric that backs up the characterization that people are making of him. He has a rhetoric that has incited violence. In his rallies, he has incited violence against people who protested. He has called killing families of terrorists, which is not only a violation of international law, it's just a violation of humanity. He has called for waterboarding and torture. He has called Mexicans rapists. He has called for a ban of a people that represents 1.6 billion, 20% of humanity in the world. And he is constantly stoking racial resentment. That's exactly the way fascist parties, Hitler, came to power. And what happens after these people get into power, not to mention the fact he does not have a good idea on how he would solve the problem, except repeating the fact that he'll make America great again. What does that mean? It's impossible to understand. Except maybe in some racial codes, that he wants to make America go back to the point where we had white people in power. And he resents the fact, and some of his...
That's your opinion.
Well, that's one of the ways that you could think about it, that the fact that there's a black man in power in the White House creates resentment among a vast group of people. And that's the way it is playing out, because what does it mean, make America great again? When did America, I mean, I'm not going to repeat campaign lines, but America has many problems, but it still remains the dominant economy in the world, remains the dominant military superpower in the world, remains one of the dominant political powers in the world, still has the ability to forge many, many great coalitions to get many good things done. So yes, power is in decline. Power is being chipped away by other rising powers like China and India and maybe even a resurgent Europe. But those things are going to happen in a world that is globalized and economic opportunities are appearing in very unpredictable ways.
Denise and Paleka, go ahead, Denise. Thanks for calling.
Good morning, and thank you. I would like to reiterate on pretty much everything that's been said this morning. And first off, point out that America is a defensive country, not offensive. And each and every one of us need to remember, freedom is not free. We should each take responsibility for our country. And that's who's responsible at each and every uprising, at each and every prayer. Peace broken anywhere is peace broken everywhere. And we need to remember as Americans what will our environmental footprint be when we leave here. And also remember, global warming is very real and fracking is bad. We need full-time jobs with benefits. And basically, this war is between the haves and the have-nots.
Thanks, Denise.
There's no race anymore. Thank you.
Thanks for that. And let's talk about what she said, because on the right, Donald Trump's populist rhetoric, which, as you've pointed out, many have also called his rhetoric inflammatory and divisive. But his populist appeal to people who see this election as a turning point in the battle between the haves and the have-nots has struck a chord with the right on the left, Bernie Sanders, although he's blaming a completely different group of people for our inequality. Bernie Sanders has struck a similar chord.
There's a difference. Bernie Sanders has a lifelong record where he has stood on the side of people who have been disadvantaged in this society. He has a lifelong record for fighting on this for these causes. Donald Trump has a lifelong record as a celebrity, as a person who is part of the establishment that has been he is criticizing now. He has benefited from that establishment. He has made millions, if not billions, of dollars through that establishment politics. And now he is trying to look like he's the outsider. Again, there is a cognitive dissonance over here on the right and the left. On the left, there is at least, you may agree or disagree with Bernie Sanders' politics, but at least there is a coherence in the message. The message and the messenger is unified. The messenger is a person with a record who has done these things. You may disagree with his ideas, and that's fine, but there is a coherence. On the right, the message and the messenger are discordant. Donald Trump's life is everything that his voters resent.
Here's an email, or a tweet rather, from Mike, pushing back on you, Parvez Ahmed. I despise Trump, but the Hitler comparison is irresponsible.
No, I understand that. As I said, I've never made this comparison with any other politician. If I did not feel strongly about it at this moment in time, I would not have made it. Again, using violence as a tool for politics, as a tool to troll for votes, using racial divisions to drive voters to the polls is, in my view, a textbook definition of what fascism is.
Here's another tweet from Maybell. Violence and racism has been here before this election. Trump did not create this American tension.
But it has been in check. In the last 30, 40 years, we have not seen it manifest in this manner. In the 60s and earlier in the history, yes, it has been part of our history. But in the last, particularly in the last 40 years or so, we have been trending, moving towards in a direction where we are not only increasingly diverse in our politics, but we are also increasingly inclusive in our politics. But that is beginning to break down right now. And in my view, it represents a point of danger.
Walker on the West Side. Hi, Walker. You're on the air.
Yes, it's good to be here. Perez Ahmad, I'm familiar with some of your work and enjoy hearing your voice again on the radio. But it's good to be on. Yes, so I wanted to say on behalf of some of the callers, or in response to some of the callers, a lot of the stuff and the accusations against Donald Trump, it's like when I look at it, and I've been following this for a little while, you know, nobody cares. And anything that Donald Trump does, it doesn't matter. People still love him. And I think that's the dissonance that you see with people. And I think the majority, as unfortunate as that sounds, the majority is more ticked off than I think the minorities are. And they've seen this past administration, you know, cater towards the minorities. And so they feel that they need to react in a response, in a way to combat that. And but my question to you is this, is along the lines of Barack Obama talking about who created Donald Trump, and he said that it wasn't him to blame, but it was more along the lines of the failed GOP or the Republicans, or you know what some of the conservatives would call rhinos. They're the ones that did it. What is both of y'all's thoughts on that matter?
All right, thanks for that, Walker.
Well, I mean, in terms of, first of all, I agree with the president that he did not create Donald Trump. He has been the victim of Donald Trump's politics ever since he took office. Remember the birtherism, that Donald Trump was the face of that movement, till this day sticks. 29% of Americans still believe Obama is a Muslim. Nearly 40% of Republicans believe he is either a Muslim or he is foreign-born. And those anxieties and those misinformation, Donald Trump was the face of that. And unfortunately, many people on the right did not push back sufficiently when Donald Trump was peddling these kinds of falsehoods.
We now see, though, leading candidates for president pushing back.
Yes, but as I said, it's too little too late. The genie is, in some sense, maybe out of the bottle. I hope the results tomorrow speak differently. I hope people come to their senses. If nothing else made sense to them, not the name calling on for Mexicans, not the attacks on Muslims, not the attacks on women or disabled people or Obama. If nothing, all of those things did not resonate with people. What I hope resonates with people is the violence in political rallies. You know, I have not seen this in the last 40 years, and so that has no place in our politics in today's age. We may have differences in opinion, but we have to resolve them civilly. When a candidate is calling from the podium to punch somebody in the face, that, I think, has crossed a line. And if he is acting this way when he is not in power, you can only imagine what this person would do when he is in power. And if that does not scare people, even the people who support him, and which, by the way, as the caller said, that people are resonating, Donald Trump is resonating with people regardless of what he says, regardless of what his ideas are. Again, that's the definition of fascism, when you are wedded to a person, not to an idea.
One more tweet. Your guest is insulting regular folks who are finally getting involved in the political process. I'm going to ask you to respond to those listening to you talk, Parvez Ahmed, who strongly disagree with what you're saying.
And they have the right to disagree. The only question is how do we air our disagreements? And the question then becomes, will we take responsibility for the choices we make?
Thanks for being with us.
Thank you.
UNF's Parvez Ahmed with us. The primary is tomorrow, and much more still ahead later. Sports with Culpepper. Also, find out about the Episcopal School's big milestone this week. And up next, critics speak out about legislation they say might endanger Florida's children. Back in a moment.
Legal and political segments on First Coast Connect, brought to you by Farrah and Farrah.
On the next Fresh Air, Dr. Theodora Ross, oncologist and cancer geneticist, tells us about her own cancer diagnosis and her search to understand the source of her family's genetic predisposition to cancer. Her new book is A Cancer in the Family. Also, Gillian Jacobs and Paul Rust, co-stars of the Netflix series Love. Join us.
Weekdays at noon on 89.9 WJCT. Your community, your world.
WJCT's Travel and Entertainment Auction is where you'll find over 300 items, most starting at 75% off at auction.wjct.org. Packages include lodging, attractions, dining, recreation, beauty, and more. Bid now. The auction continues through March 21st at 8 p.m. Log on to auction.wjct.org for more information.
These Ohioans all have something in common.
I'm Jim Sperlino.
Kevin White. Terry King.
My name is Joe Matvey.
Scott George.
Tim Derrickson.
They're all Republicans, they're all conservative, and they're all running for the same seat in Congress.
My name is Bill Beagle.
Warren Davidson.
My name is Eric Hammerly.
My name is Ed Meir.
John Robin.
My name is Mike Smith.
Katie Winterick.
And I'm George Woolley.
The crowded field to succeed John Boehner later on All Things Considered from NPR News. Weekdays at 4 on 89.9 WJCT.
Welcome back. Well, legislation was filed this session in Florida Senate and House that critics say would weaken the state's child passenger safety law and ultimately endanger children. I spoke about it with child safety advocate Grania Kelly. Grania Kelly, thanks so much for being with us.
You're welcome, Melissa. It's my pleasure.
And can you begin by sharing with us your concerns about this legislation? Why are you speaking out?
I think it's very difficult now that we have, in January of 2014, the law was passed for children traveling on booster seats up until age six. So in most of the states in the U.S., we're trying to increase the age limit on booster seats to bring it more in line with the legislations in Europe. In Europe, for example, children should be riding in booster seats until basically the height of 4'9", which is really the age they are whenever they're a small adult. So what they've done is they have certainly increased the age limit to age six, which is still, in our opinion, too low. And now they're saying that children who are travelling, for example, with childcare facilities or daycare or an after-school program, that they don't need to ride in a booster seat. And it doesn't make any sense to us. Why would you have that exemption? Because a child is not going to be in any lesser danger on those journeys.
Mm-hmm. You're a certified child passenger safety technician. You founded a device called Bubble Bum that it uses inflatable technology to help parents keep their kids safe if they're out on the road and especially in a booster seat. So this is personal for you, right?
It's personal for me. And the reason that I had come up with the Bubble Bum was exactly one of the reasons that they're giving for changing this law. And it was back in 2009 when I was traveling with my own children. And when I went to a car rental desk, for example, they didn't have the car booster seat when I got there. And it's a real risk for parents. And they don't seem to understand a lot of the time. And to be honest with you, because I knew it was the law in the UK at the time where I was, I knew that I had to have my children properly protected, but I didn't really understand why. And when I started looking into the reality behind what actually happens in the event of a crash, I thought a booster seat, Melissa, was designed just to raise a child up. And then I thought, oh, it's designed just to position the shoulder belt. But actually, what a booster seat does is it prevents the lap belt from riding up into the soft tissues in the abdomen in the event of a crash. And In the event of a crash with a booster-age child, if they're not in a booster seat, it's the vehicle's seatbelt more often than not that does the damage to the child. So it's to try and protect that area in the child by using a booster seat.
Mm-hmm.
And I think a lot of times it's down to a lack of planning on behalf of the carer or the parent when they're traveling without a booster seat for the child.
And this legislation, specifically the part of the bill that you're concerned about, would change the law so that kids aged 4 and 5 would not need a separate carrier, child seat, or booster seat, in particular if they're being transported by a child care facility or daycare facility or after-school program, correct?
Yeah, that is correct. If there were, and my solution is not the only solution on the market. There are other solutions on the market for this problem. And I think had it been 10 years ago, before any of these solutions were on the market, I can understand why parents may have struggled to find something suitable for their child to travel with. But really, if a parent understands that their child is 59% safer riding with the correct restraint, they're actually not going to have their child traveling without the correct restraint. You're not going to throw your child in the swimming pool without their water wings on if they can't swim. You will take a precaution to ensure that they're kept safe because you understand the repercussions of that action. And I think a lot of the difficulty for parents is that they don't understand the repercussions of their child riding without a booster seat. And I think that's being very unfair to parents, this particular law, changing this law, because it's luring them into a false sense of security as well.
We'll continue to follow this. In the meantime, thanks so much for being with us. Up next, sports with Cole, plus Jacksonville's Episcopal School marks 50 years of excellence. We'll tell you about it.
You want to talk economic anxiety? We can talk economic anxiety.
You know, the big one is, are your finances keeping you up at night? And it's 30% of Americans say that their current financial situation is causing them to lose sleep.
I'm Kai Rizdahl, the Marketplace Edison Research Poll, second edition, next time.
Weekday evenings at 6 on 89.9 WJCT, your community, your world.
I'm Al Letson, and I'm hosting a brand new show here on WJCT, and I'm bringing some friends with me.
Aerothang, with Al Letson as the host and Willie Evans Jr. as the DJ. Well, he's not really a DJ, but he does something.
Every week, we'll be bringing you some stories, some laughs, and something to think about. Sundays at 2 and Wednesdays at 1. Aerothang. It's a new show, because we're going to do Aerothang we want.
Aerothang, the opposite of nothing.
Racial lines don't always make party lines.
The African-American vote and the Latino vote are not, there's not a consensus around particular candidates or even a particular party.
American politicians forced to confront the changing face and faith of America. That's next time on The Takeaway from WNYC and PRI, Public Radio International.
Weekdays at 2 on 89.9 WJCT.
Coming up on The Next Reveal.
Who asked you to give that money?
I don't recall who asked me.
A shocking discovery at a run-of-the-mill city council meeting.
I think it put, you know, right there in front of the public what I would have considered sleaze.
Money in politics, from Anytown, USA to the presidential race. On The Next Reveal from the Center for Investigative Reporting and PRX.
Thursday at 1 on 89.9 WJCT.
Welcome back. Well, tomorrow, the Episcopal School of Jacksonville celebrates its 50th anniversary with a Founders Day celebration and an emphasis on the school's founding mission of excellence in academic service, sports, arts, and leadership. Jill Dame, the school's 50th anniversary committee chair, Board of Trustees member, graduate and parent of two alumni, by the way, is here now to tell us all about it. Good morning.
Good morning, Melissa.
And of course, you're also the CEO of Leadership Jacksonville. Lots of excitement as Episcopal celebrates 50 years. This is really quite a milestone. You're going to have a mayoral proclamation and much more.
We are. It's a huge year for us, celebrating 50 years of incredible people, and those are who we celebrate. It's our Founders Chapel. So we are thanking and celebrating all that they did to get us started 50 years ago from nothing, from the ground floor.
That's right. It began in 1966, in part because of a donation from philanthropist Jesse Ball DuPont.
Right. We originally got the land. The land for the campus was given to the St. John's Cathedral way back in the early 1900s, 1912. And it was used for a variety of purposes until the time came to get us started. And Mrs. DuPont made an original gift of $300,000 in 1967, which would be about $2 million today, that really helped with the building and the early construction.
And over time, as the school has grown, here are some notable facts. The first graduating class was 1970. Just 6 years later, the 76-77 Episcopal swim team was named national champions. Episcopal held its mortgage burning ceremony in January of 1983 and has been debt-free ever since. The first children of alumni graduated back in 96, and just a few of the notable alumni include Olympic gold medalist Nancy Hogshead McCarr and her sister Sally Hogshead, British Open winner David Duval, the number one ranked golfer in the world, and even a fashion designer, is it Timo Weiland?
Yes.
Yeah,
yes.
Just a few of the graduates over there. And, of course, Jill Dane.
Right, right. We've got some great ones. We have a bishop up in Tennessee, and they're spreading all over the country doing amazing things.
And over the years, how do you see Episcopal really becoming a part of the landscape here in Jacksonville, an integral institution?
Well, one of the things we focus on with the students at Episcopal is excellence in everything they do. And we consider that to be not only the academic and the sports, but the social service, the leadership component. And we see them involved in a variety of programs. They're volunteering at Daniel's summer camps. They're volunteering throughout the community, and they take that into their adult life for service and leadership. And one day we're going to have a mayor, I would predict, that's a graduate of Episcopal School of Jacksonville.
So tomorrow is the big celebration, tomorrow at 10 a.m. On the campus. Not too late for people to mark their calendars and be part of it.
Absolutely not. And if they can't be there tomorrow, we would love to have alums at our 50th gala later in the spring. We're having our first annual, we hope, not annual, but every couple of years, Alumni Hall of Fame honor induction. And we'll have a lot of other exciting events that folks can participate in.
So again, if you're just tuning in, Episcopal School of Jacksonville will celebrate its 50th anniversary tomorrow with a special Founders Day celebration on the Episcopal campus. Lots of excitement for teachers, students, and alumni of Episcopal. Jill Dame, a graduate, she has two children who are alumni, and she's chairing the school's 50th anniversary committee, among other things she does. Thanks so much for being with us, and have fun.
Thanks so much.
And finally, this hour, March Madness is upon us.
I'm a pepper, he's a pepper, she's a pepper, we're a pepper, wouldn't you like to be a pepper too?
With more about college basketball and the rest of this week's sports news and notes, here's our own Cole Pepper. And you know, Cole, lots of great athletes have come out of Episcopal.
Yes, one who I work with quite often, as a matter of fact, the current athletic director at Episcopal, Andy Kidd, who was a star soccer player, coach there, was a captain at Furman when Clint Dempsey of the U.S. national team was there, and he's an analyst with the Armada in his spare time, too. So, and my wife's an Episcopal alum, so a lot of connections with Episcopal.
And recently we had Mark Brunell here in studio. Of course, he's a coach there, so lots of great athletic tradition at Episcopal. Meanwhile, it is officially March Madness time in college basketball, and how are your brackets looking?
Well, so far they look great because they haven't played any games. Yesterday, as Selection Sunday, all of the field of 68 has been laid out. The first four start on Tuesday, and then the rest of the action begins in earnest on Thursday and Friday with the first round games. Top seeds in the tournament this year: Kansas, the number one overall seed, In a year of great parity, it's amazing that by the time the season came to an end, it's the Blue Bloods that wound up rising to the top. North Carolina is the number one seed, Virginia, and then a bit of a surprise with Oregon. Some thought that Michigan State would be a shoo-in as a number one seed. They were not, but a lot of folks picking Michigan State as a two seed to get all the way through, and some picking fourth seed Kentucky, who had a big, strong finish to the season.
You can't go wrong with betting on Kentucky at this time of year.
Right. They've had such great success. I will also point out that there has been a tradition of 12 seeds beating five seeds in the first round. It happens just about every year. So if you're sizing up your office pool and you want to make sure that you don't get beaten by Janice in accounting, who always seems to win every year, a couple of games you might want to take a look at are those 5-12 games, fifth seeds against 12 seeds. An intriguing one I don't think is going to be an upset, but I think it's an intriguing matchup, is Baylor against Yale.
Really?
Yeah, you have an Ivy League team as a 12 seed. They've been very good this year.
Okay.
Baylor's long, athletic. They've got some real strength, but they've struggled in the NCAA tournament in recent years, so that may be one area you might go to. University of Arkansas, Little Rock takes on Purdue. Not a great 5-12 upset pick there. And the other one is Chattanooga against Indiana. Chattanooga lost just five games all year. They're a 12 seed from a smaller conference. Indiana had a terrific year in the Big Ten, didn't play as well in the Big Ten tournament, but that might be where you could find an upset in the first round as well.
All right. So are you putting your picks online anywhere? Can we track your progress?
Or
are you still blogging about that stuff?
I could do that, and you could have hours going, what in the world is this guy thinking?
You do pretty well, though, I think.
I would tell you this. This year, there were among the top four seeds, there are more losses among the four top seeds than any year in the history of the tournament. A part of that is there were more games played now than there were, say, in the 60s and 70s. But you have more losses. There was more parity this year. I think that means you're going to get a lot of crazy results in the first two rounds. And by the time things shake out, I think there are really about 12 or 13 teams that can truly win the national title. And I suspect that most of them will be involved there in the final 16.
Excellent. Well, what else is happening?
Well, we've got Florida and UNF, who did not make the NCAA tournament, but both will play one another in the NIT on Tuesday night at UNF. Tickets are being snatched up quickly by very excited UNF fans and probably mildly excited UF fans who would just as soon be in the NCAA tournament.
Right.
Florida State also made it to the Little Dance. They'll take on Davidson in the first round. Okay. And the other basketball news to get to you, for the first time in program history, the JU Dolphins women's team has won the Atlantic Sun Conference tournament.
Congrats to them.
Yeah, Coach McPhee got the victory over Florida Gulf Coast in an upset, and so JU's women will be going to the NCAA basketball tournament.
Speaking of women's basketball, I also noticed a settlement over at UNF with they parted ways with their former women's basketball coach, the only one they've ever had.
Yeah, remember, they went Division I here fairly recently, so both JU and UNF are fairly new into this is only 16 years for JU, so it's not a long time tradition of women's basketball in the city. Certainly JU celebrating, and UNF probably, from an administration standpoint, happy to get that behind them.
Right. Now, the Armada also playing this week, Tuesday at JU, and Friday they're away.
You know, they actually are at home on Friday against Ryo OKC.
Oh, sorry, yes.
But it is at Patton Park, not their usual home stadium. Patton Park is the training facility out near San Pablo. So two matches this week in the preseason. Second time that the Armada will be taking on a college team. They played UNF to a 0-0 draw last month, and then they'll play against Flagler next month. So three college matchups in the preseason. But Ryo OKC is an interesting club. They are owned by a Spanish La Liga team, and Rayo Vallecano, and they've started to make some pretty big signings, including recently adding a member of the U.S. national team, a former member of the U.S. national team, Robbie Finley. So that's going to be intriguing to see. An expansion team, and that'll be on Friday. That's free to the public, by the way, if you want to go out and see some soccer.
You've even got your Jacksonville Armada Football Club shirt on today.
Total coincidence, but
yeah,
yes.
Yeah, looking good there.
Thank you.
Last but not least, the Jaguars in free agency.
Yeah, one of the most recent moves, and the Jaguars have been very active and have gotten rave reviews around the National Football League for their free agency activity. The most recent move was signing cornerback Prince Amukamara, which in addition to being a fantastic name, is also a very good player. When he's been healthy, he's been very good, and he will be installed at cornerback. So the position areas of need that the Jaguars had coming into free agency, a lot of them they have addressed. Defensive line help, they got that in Malik Jackson. They were able to get Amukamara as a cornerback. That was a big move. They also signed a second running back in Chris Ivory. So a lot of these positions that the Jaguars needed to address, they have. They still haven't really solved the question of pass rush from the edge. Dante Fowler Jr., the rookie first-round pick last year, who blew out his knee 30 minutes into his first practice, is expected to be back this year. You never know how a rookie or how an injured player is going to respond. So I think that pass rush is going to continue to be an issue that they approach in the draft, which comes up now 45 days from today.
And we're getting tweets about legislation legalizing free agency for high school sports, but we'll talk about that another day.
Yeah, and I will just say one point on this is that some will tell you there's already been that because of the magnet programs and the ability for players to transfer, but this is going to be interesting to see how this plays out.
Right. As we follow that, you can follow Cole on Twitter at Cole Pepper. Thanks as always.
Thanks, Melissa.
That's our show. Thanks to all of our guests and callers this morning. Our producer is Sean Birch. The show theme composed and performed by the Jacksonville Symphony Orchestra's Pyotr Chepchik. Never miss a show. Subscribe to the daily podcast on iTunes and Stitcher. And you can now watch the show video on demand at tvjax.com. Next on Die and Ream, ahead of Tuesday's key primaries, a big push by many Republican leaders to stop front runner Donald Trump. The rise of Trump and what his candidacy means for a divided GOP. That conversation is next. I'm Melissa Ross, and you're listening to First Coast Connect on 89.9 WJCT FM Jacksonville. Your community, your world. We'll be right back here again at 9 a.m. tomorrow and all through the evening with full coverage of the Florida primary election. See you then.
Support for First Coast Connect is provided by Baptist Health and the North Florida TPO.